following along in the PowerPoint, we are in session 10 now, the three developmental questions. And I had you read this for our class today. I think you guys all read it, right? So hopefully this will be make it a lot easier for you to be able to understand what we're talking about here, because it'll be familiar to you. In this regard, I am moving from our third step in the preaching expository sermons process. I'm moving from the third step to the fourth step. This is actually the fourth step in Haddon Robinson's 10-step procedure as well. So the idea here is to go from the CPT, or the exegetical idea, to the purpose bridge to see, you know, what are we going to do in terms of this sermon? What do we want the people actually to feel, to think, to do? These are three questions that help us develop that purpose. Thus, they're called developmental questions. This presupposes that you already have your exegetical outline done. I had you work today on 9 different paragraphs to give me the exegetical outline in assignment number 3. Did you find that challenging? What did you find challenging about it?
I don't know. It's like some passages are too short. And,
some were short. Then that made it more difficult?
Yeah, it's like the risk is higher. You know,
you have higher risk because it's very short.
We need a few sentences to concise the thought. So 1-2 sentences.
All right. So you think having more sentences is going to make it more easy? Maybe that does help at certain times. Natalie? You found it challenging to include everything. Okay.
Like, I kind of found myself doubting, because I think this summarizes this well, but then maybe I'm missing out a component. I'm not sure.
Of course, you know, to take any piece of literature, whether it's a couple sentences or a 424-page dissertation, you have to leave some out. But what it does is it challenges you to ask, okay, well, what do I leave out? What's the essential teaching in the assignment for today? What's the essential teaching in some of these magazine articles that were quite short, a paragraph or two, or scripture passages? So, you find exegetical outlining difficult. Let me quote you my Greek professor back from 1983, Dr. John Best. Oh, didn't he have a great name? He has a great name, Best. I had the best Greek professor, because his name was Best, you know? He said, everything we do with ease, at one time we did with difficulty. When we got a little discouraged in our Greek, luo, lues, lue, luemin, you know, you're like, okay, I got that, but how about the second declension and all these other things? You know, when I got into all that, I thought, this is really difficult. Why does Greek have 24 different words for the? You know, why can't you just say the, like in English? It's so easy, you know. And when Dr. Best told our class that everything we do with ease, like saying, everything we do with ease, I could say that very easily right now. At one time, that was a very difficult thing to say. To balance in this chair was very difficult for me at some point. To hold this, certainly to set up this computer, etc., all these things used to be a huge challenge. And I don't even think about them anymore because I've done them so many times that these things are, you know, they're easy now. I had the problem of trying to remember, because I was the first one to class, to remember the combination to get in this classroom today. And I thought, oh, man. What is that again? You know, I was still doing it with difficulty because I haven't done it enough. Even though I've taught in this room several times, I haven't taught consistently enough to get the combination down. So I had to look it up. You know, that's kind of how life is. So be encouraged. You will get to the point where this process that we're going through right now actually will be second nature to you if you follow it through, you know, a few times. So, okay, let's say, for example, if we're going to go through this process on Ephesians 6:4, how do we actually raise children? You know, Ephesians 6:4, feel free to look it up in your Bible, but I will also put it right here for you, all right? This is how it reads in the New American Updated Version. Fathers, do not provoke your children to anger, but bring them up in the discipline and instruction of the Lord. I've had some students preach this passage. I don't have any of you preaching it, do I? Not supposed to. this is one of the few passages that's direct command to fathers that you find in the Bible. So for fathers like me, I found this pretty instructive. And my wife and I have talked about this verse many, many times, hundreds of times, the past 32 years that we've been parents, you know? If it helps, there's the Greek. And I give the same structure to it here in the Greek. The NAU doesn't translate the chi. It's just hoi pateres. Now, what does pateres mean? Does it mean mothers? So these are some of the things we want to observe, of course, looking at the Greek text can be helpful. There's the command. Me par. Para gridate. Ooh, doesn't that sound like? Don't provoke. Para gridate. Boy, that just sounds like provoking, doesn't it? What does ta tekna mean? Human. What is a child? Do you see all the questions? We're going back to the questions. What does this mean? Don't provoke. What does this mean? Your children. Ah, look at that. Allah. Instead of de. Allah compared to de. You know the difference, right? They both mean but. But what's the difference between these two buts? Da is softer, you know? Oh, but do this. Allah is, don't do this, but do this. And you see the first is negative and the second is a double positive, you know? But bring them up. And then that's modified in two ways you bring them up, in the discipline and the instruction of the Lord. Look at that, instruction of the Lord. Nuthesia is not didaskalon. It's not your normal word for teaching, for teacher. It doesn't have the idea of the classroom. Bring them up in your family classroom. You know, when you just make some observations like this, it will really help you to be able to actually preach this passage. So we'll study it. And what I normally do is I have three basic questions that I ask before I actually get into the passage that I'm going to preach. Last Sunday I preached Malachi 2, 10 to 16. So I asked these three questions. Well, what was in right up to Malachi 2, up to verse 9? What did he say right before that? That's important. When we get into Ephesians 6, we'll see that he says children should obey their parents. And he says this is a command that begins, that ends with a promise, you know, that you'll have a long life. Pretty cool, huh?
Some of my friends say they want a long life.
They don't want a long life.
They want to live so long, they want to die.
He doesn't say how long the life's going to be. I've had a long life. 61 years is not bad compared to this time. What your friends mean when they say they don't want a long life is they don't want to be languishing the last 20 years of their life laying in bed wondering when they're going to die, right? Yeah, I understand that. But he says children should obey their parents, and that's in a larger context of believers should submit to one another. Hupomeno, you know, to remain under, or to isn't that the word for submit? It appears several times here in Ephesians. So this is in the larger context of submitting. Do you see how a father's perspective toward his children is going to show some level of submission? If I'm going to not provoke my children to anger, don't I have to submit some of my rights to do that? To bring them up in the nurture and the admonition of the Lord, it takes some submission on my part. Not just leadership, but humble leadership. Anyway, second question I ask of every passage is, well, why is this in the Bible? You know, what would be different with our Bible if we didn't actually have this passage? That's a great question to ask. Every passage in Scripture has a unique place. Even if the verse is exactly the same as a verse somewhere else in a different book, it's still fitting in a different manner. So my answer to this as I was working on this is, well, parents need to know how to raise their kids. You talk about one of the most relevant subjects for us to learn, for those of us who are parents. This is one of the most important skills you ever need to learn in your life. And then I would also put, fathers tend to be harsh with their children. The passage says, fathers, do not exasperate your children. Do you notice it doesn't say mothers, don't exasperate your children? Why? What's your experience? Is your experience more that fathers tend to exasperate their children more or mothers do? Yours is mothers, okay. You had a fighter mother, maybe tiger mom or something like that. That question maybe doesn't work in the Chinese context. But in most societies, it's the fathers that can more easily anger their children, as the mothers have that softer side and they're more nurturing. Fathers are more concerned about principles and responsibility and discipline and doing the right thing. Mothers are more concerned about, I'm telling you about my own family. You know, I mean, I want all those things for my sons as they were growing up, but they're in their 20s and 30s now, you know. And my wife was more like, let's guard the relationship. If we come down too hard right now, we're going to push them away. She's told me that 337 times, I think. No, I'm kidding, but I don't remember how many. But. And then what historical background helps us understand this passage? That's a very helpful one as well. What was life like in Ephesus? What can we learn about how Ephesian fathers related to their children? What can we learn from archaeology? You know one thing we learned from Ephesus? They've dug up the archaeology at Ephesus, and they have all the names of all the provincial, all the government officials. We're talking about many, many different monuments. There's not one woman among them. This is written in a context where the whole government was basically men. And we know from first century Greek society, it truly favored boys. So there's a lot of pressure put on these boys. Now, somehow a lot of women think that that's unfair. They should have as much pressure put on them. So we have this feminist movement come up. Hey, we should have as much pressure on us as on the boys. You know, I'm kidding, but you know, maybe not. And that now we have this kind of pressure on women as well. But anyway, those are questions that I try to ask, you know, and try to answer before I get into trying. This is going to help me either interpret or misinterpret when I'm preaching Ephesians 6:4. So when I think I've preached this passage to the men at my church, you know. So then that's part of the questions, but what other questions would you then ask? You know, you guys, you have your computers ahead of me, so you can, I know you can advance and you can see all these. I don't want that to ruin it for you, right? because you're looking at the PowerPoint, you know, of what I'm doing. Yeah, there's right. Oh, you're not. Oh, no PowerPoint. Oh, yeah, he's got it. She's got it. You know, if you're in the design mode, then you can see the whole slide there, right? Esther, so maybe it's better to put it into. I want you to think through. What would be some of these questions you would ask of this text? Help me out here. What questions would you have of the passage? What does provoke mean? That's a very good question. Does provoke mean I don't have my children to have any responsibility? Of course not. You know? Why fathers? Why fathers in particular? There you go. Why not mothers? Or does this mean parents? I think if you look in some of your translations, I think in the NLT, you could check. Does it say parents? Yeah. Some of the translations just say parents, so they're including both fathers and mothers in this. Maybe because they know some of the tiger moms. Yeah. When you provoke children, do you provoke them to anger particularly? You don't provoke them to fear, provoke them to depression, or provoke them to... Yeah, good, great question. When does it stop? In other words, ta tekna, who is a child? Am I a child? Does this apply to my parents? My mother in her 80s? And how she responds to her son in his 60s? Do I take this now with my sons in their 20s and 30s? Yeah, they're still my children. It's true, but they're out of the home. They're on their own. This same thing still would apply also to the Ten Commandments. Children, obey your parents. Or the verse before, Ephesians 6:1. Children, obey your parents. Do you have responsibility to obey your parents? Everybody here is 20 and 30 years old. All of you kind of nod your head, you know. I had to really address that question at age 22. Now, Natalie and I are the only Westerners here. And so Natalie's kind of like, no, I don't think. Yeah. Natalie and I are going to look at this differently, being Westerners. I had to ask the question at age 22, finishing college. My mother wanted me to be a businessman. I wanted to be a missionary. What should I do? If I followed my mother, then I would have been a businessman. You know, but I respectfully said, Mom, Jesus is most important in my life, and I need to do this. But I did major in business in honor of my mother. So I graduated with a business degree. And so my mom, then she said, my son graduates with honors from business school and then goes and becomes a missionary, begging for money.
After studying the business, realize it's a tough world. It's better to become a missionary.
The business world is a tough world. It's better to become a missionary. Oh, I became a missionary because it's so much easier than being a businessman. Huh? Let me tell you a little bit about missions. You know, I've been a missionary for 30 years, you know, and in many ways it's far easier to be a businessman, but I don't know, I haven't had a lot of time as a businessman. But these are the kinds of questions you want to ask in this passage. If you have questions of it right now, just kind of coming to it, well, certainly the people that are going to hear you preach this passage are going to have these questions. Best, as I said before, best to write them down now and answer them. So, that's what I did with Malachi last week. I had the seven verses. I had 17 questions about those seven verses. And so, I wrote them all out. Most of those I addressed in my sermon. Because I think that most of the people would have those questions. If it's obvious, then I didn't really address it. Generally, it won't be a question if it's obvious anyway. So we come up with questions like this. Well, who was Paul writing? none of you said that. Who are these Ephesians? Were they Christians? Were they non-Christians? Why is it addressed fathers? Aren't mothers also raising children? How are we to treat children? None of you said, what does it mean to exasperate them? But this is a really important point. What kind of training's meant here? Is it different? Is training different than instruction? What's meant by the instruction of the Lord? How long should fathers do this? Does the Greek word for fathers help us understand how long obedience lasts? You catch what I mean? This is what I want you to do for the sermon that you're going to preach in class. I want you to ask these kinds of questions of this passage, the passage you're going to preach. Because you're going to study it and all that, and you'll come up and preach it, but the rest of us, we're not going to be studying that passage. We've got our own passages to study. So I encourage you to gain the skill of Q&A. Answer the questions as well. All right? So that's part of the one, study. Then two is structure. Yes, Natalie? I don't necessarily answer them all. Of course, it depends how much time I have.
Where do you find the answers?
Where do I find the answers? A lot of times the text itself or cross-references, commentaries, looking up Greek word studies. I would look for... I mean, you covered this in your other classes, so I'm kind of skipping this, but what's it means to exasperate? Look up the Greek word for exasperate. What was it? Whatever it was. What does it mean, instruction of the Lord? Where does that phrase appear in the New Testament? The instruction of the Lord. Does it appear somewhere else in the New Testament? I don't know. That's why it's a question. I just don't know. And I want to go find it and see, ooh, if I see that in another passage, maybe that's going to help me understand what Ephesians 6:4 is talking about. Is the word fathers, pater, is that used in reference to women sometimes in the New Testament? That'll be helpful. Seems a little strange to use that phrase in reference to women, but I was drawing the contrast in James 1, where it says that one who hears the word and doesn't do anything about it is like a man who looks in the mirror and then just goes away and forgets what he's talking about. I was drawing that distinction in my class earlier today. The word there is not anthropos. It's not like a person who looks in the mirror and then goes away and forget what he or she looks like. It's specifically the word aner, man, husband, male. I think James is trying to bring out a point that us men, we can look in the mirror, like I did all last week, look in the mirror, oh yeah, hair's kind of long, whatever. And I walk away and completely forget the whole rest of the day. I don't think about the fact that hair's over my ears and it doesn't really look that good. And the next morning, like, oh yeah, that's right. Yeah, my hair's a little bit long, you know. Maybe I should do something about that, you know. But my wife would be looking at me. So I tell my wife, it's more important for what I look like to you than to me, because you look at me more than I look at me, you know. I think the newer translations that say, you know, seeing God's word and then not doing anything about it is like a person who looks in the mirror. I think they're missing the point. The text is specifically talking about men, because men don't do anything about it when they go see something's out of order. Women are a lot more diligent. Women see something there's wrong there and they stay there and they fix it. You know? I mean, this is seen, just honestly, I'll just tell you about my life. I don't look at myself more than 30 seconds in the morning, but my wife doesn't look at herself more than 30 minutes in the morning. Yeah? There's a difference. That's why I make breakfast. Because she's looking at herself, you know? And she's getting her hair just right and her makeup right, and, you know, that's why she looks better than I do. So you have to ask these questions of the text. Why is it using this word instead of this word? And I don't know. I haven't done the word study on pater, But my bet is that word's not used in reference to women anywhere in the New Testament. I might be wrong. But this is the discovery part that's just so fun in being able to study it.
It could also be a context, right?
Yeah. Yeah, that would be the cultural context, that they understood fathers to be definitely more harsh. Was it true? Were Greek fathers more harsh than Greek mothers? My guess is yes, based on this text. Can we find that in other Greek literature? A good commentary is going to bring you over to Josephus or to some other... Like I was talking about the Ephesian ruins, that sort of thing. This is what makes preaching interesting to the listeners. They'll say, "Wow, really? Did you actually look up the architecture of Greek buildings for this sermon?" You know, oh, I didn't go there and look it up in Ephesus, but I learned about it through an article that I read on this. That it gives a lot of good background. Well, then you want to go to structure. What's the basic structure of this passage? Without you kind of clicking ahead on your computer, what do you think is the basic structure here? Is this going to give you a two-point sermon, three-point sermon? Is it like a two-point structure, a three-point structure, four-point structure? What do you see in it? How many commands are there here? Two. Correct. And what are the two commands? Don't provoke, but bring them up. What do you notice about those two? They're opposites. So this passage is saying, don't do this. Instead, do this. Isn't that wonderful? I mean, if you want to learn about something, isn't it great to learn how not to do it and then also learn how to do it? I mean, it's like being taught twice in two different ways. That's a great thing. So I did it like this. I thought, well, there's a negative way, and here's my Z1X, Z2Y, okay? The way Ephesians fathers should raise their children was by not provoking them. There's my exegetical statement. I could take out the word negative there, but anyway, hopefully that helps. And then there's also another way that's positive. The way Ephesians fathers should raise their children, was by guiding them. I'm saying guiding them in God's ways. I'm trying to think of a word that will sum up both train and instruct. I don't want to pick the word train. I don't want to pick the word instruct. I want to pick some word that's going to sum up these two. So the best I can think of is guiding them. So it looks like basically a two-point structure here. Now I want to take those two points, the negative and the positive, but I don't want to preach those as two different ideas for this passage. I want to sum up the passage in one sentence, the exegetical idea, or the CPT. So I try to get both of these ideas in there, but not make the sentence so long that it's, you know, three lines for the first one, three lines for the second one. I don't want to make it so long that it's six lines long. So I pick the not provoking in verse 4a, and I picked the guiding in verse 4b and c. And in this sense, I'm giving a double compliment on my exegetical idea. The way Ephesian fathers should raise their children was by guiding rather than provoking them. You guys have thoughts about this, feel free to interject them. I could preach that, but I'm not preaching to Ephesian fathers. I'm preaching to my audience today. So I'm going to, but I want to keep these things in there. I want to keep the idea, This passage is a how-to passage. A lot of passages are not. A lot of passages are talking about the reason we should do something or whatever, when we should do something. But so they both of these say way, point one and point two. So I'm not going to put the reason Ephesians fathers should da-da-da-da, because that wouldn't make sense. I really wouldn't be preaching the passage. I want to get both the ideas of provoking and guiding into my exegetical idea. So basically, this is what I want you to do for your assignment next week on Colossians 4:6. I want you to give me like three sentences like this. Maybe if you say there's 3 points to the passage, you'll have 4 sentences. Colossians 4:6 says, "Let your speech always be with grace, seasoned as it were with salt, so that you may know how to respond to each person." It's about the same length as Ephesians 6:4. You can do a whole sermon on that sentence. I did, and I preached it in chapel some years back. So this is what I want you to do on your assignment. All right? So to form that exegetical idea, you get the main points of your exegetical outline, and then you add them up to get your central proposition of the text or your exegetical idea. That's kind of how you do it. Some other examples in your notes, page 116, you'll find Nehemiah 1-2. Nehemiah is disturbed about what's happened at the wall broken down in Jerusalem, and he goes back. I called it the means by which God is actually doing some wonderful thing among Nehemiah and the people to restore the wall. Well, I have 3 points, and all three of them relate to the means. So that's pretty simple, right? Nehemiah 1-2. Feel free to look these up, you know. Clear? That one's pretty easy. How about John 13, my sermon on page 152. I also preached in chapel some years back. What's John 13 actually saying? I call it dirty saints. Jesus washing the disciples' feet, basically. I show the reason. The reason Jesus washed their feet was to show his love in the most humble way possible. Second point. The reason Jesus washed the disciples' feet in such a humble manner was to shame them for their pride. So try to prove that from the text. The third one, the reason Jesus washed their feet was to show how love humbly serves others. That's pretty simple. Reason, reason, reason. So this text is given. You could either, in your exegetical idea, you can sum them all up. That's what I've done this. Or you can give all three. That's called multiple compliments. I think it's best to sum them all up, generally. Because your goal is not for your people to go, oh yeah, this, and this, and this. You know, on Sunday I talked about, I had three compliments, I had three main points, and they were all relating to the way. But for my exegetical idea, I didn't say, the way is this way, and this way, and this way. I summed them all up in one way. That's what I've done here in your exegetical idea. The reason Jesus washed the disciples' feet in such a way was to shame them for their pride. In such a way as to shame them for their pride was to set an example of love humbly serving others. I'm trying to get actually that all three main points into that. When I get to Psalm 23, that's a little bit more difficult. Page 46. Your assignment for next week should look like the top of page 46. And later, you'll add the bottom of page 46, a similar sort of thing for Colossians 4:6. I have the response of David to God's provision and protection like a shepherd does for his sheep was comfort instead of fear. David felt comfort. That was his response. But then the manner, or the way, verse 5. The way God showed his goodness was by protecting David, so he was honored like a banqueting victor. Oh, that kind of shifts thing a little bit. That's not talking about what David's responses. That's what God's, how God was treating him. And then I have the response at the end. The response of David to God's continued goodness was to commit to commune with the Lord at the tabernacle the rest of his life. So that's response again. So what am I going to do for my exegetical idea to really, truly preach all of Psalm 23? Well, the response kind of wins out, because I've got two of them are actually talking about the response. So that seems to be the emphasis. What David is saying in Psalm 23 is, Lord, in light of how you treat me, that's the manner, this is how I respond to you. No fear, communion with you instead. So I say, the response of David to God's goodness shown in providing for and protecting him was to fearlessly commune with God at the tabernacle the rest of his life. Now, will that preach? If you've got a very intellectually oriented audience, perhaps it will. But most audiences, that's not going to preach. That's too long. It's too cumbersome. It's relating to David. It's relating to shepherd imagery and stuff. People aren't going to get that. I'm going to need to connect to bring that into a homiletical idea. Okay? Now, actually, what I've... Yes? Now? For Colossians 4:6, your assignment should look like the top.
But you also said that we need to follow the points on...
Page 22? If you follow the guidelines of page 22, you will end up with something like the top of page 46.
But I mean, for example, like, it asks every reason the questions and answers of the text.
Oh, okay. So that part is added, so yeah, follow that one. Give me your Q&A for the text, which I don't do for Psalm 23.
Background, context.
Yeah.
So all of those should be added. That's fine.
Yes, you should do that. Show me kind of what you've studied to get you to actually getting to the exegetical outline. Yeah, that's a good point. Okay, I haven't actually done what I said I was going to do yet, and that's the three developmental questions. I'm reviewing steps 1, 2, and 3 for you. So let me do that for a few minutes, and then we'll take a break. So here's back to page 38, gives us our ideas here about developmental questions. Here's, if you make a proposition, if you make a statement, you're really only going to do three things that can be done with any given statement, idea, whether it be the main idea of the message or one of the points within it. You're only going to either explain the statement, you're going to prove the statement, or you're going to apply the statement. Don't think there's other things you actually can do with it. You're going to fall into one of these major categories. Let me give you an example that Haddon Robinson gives when he was teaching here in Singapore. Let's suppose you say, it's going to be freezing today. You ready? There you go. What do you think of that? It's going to be freezing today. I just thought you guys want to know this. What's your response to that? I'm not being sarcastic. Okay, so there's my answer. No, not being sarcastic. Very good. Are you in Singapore? Well, I guess I better explain it, right? You're really asking me to explain it. So I should say, what do I need to explain? If I tell my class it's going to be freezing today, I probably ought to give some more context to that. I better explain it. So I say, oh, it's going to be 30 degrees. Does that help? That explains it.
Degrees?
That is not freezing.
Fahrenheit.
It's going to be 30 degrees Fahrenheit. You have to remember, I'm American, so I still think in 32 degrees is freezing, you know? So this is 2 degrees below freezing, right?
In Singapore.
Now, I do need to explain that, how it's going to be freezing here in Singapore. So I need to probably more than just explain it. I need to prove it to you, right? But some passages explain themselves. So give that explanation. Always explain what you mean in your passage. Don't be like the pastor that I heard once who just said he was preaching in the backwoods of Texas and I was a guest, you know, in the audience. Ho, everyone that thirsts, come to the water. Ho, everyone that thirsts, come to the water. He must have said that because that was his text in Isaiah. Must have said that like at least 30 times during his sermon. And I'm going, you got a lot of farmers here who use a hoe, H-O-E. I wonder how many of these farmers are thinking, ho, in other words, get to work, you know. The text actually says H-O. Why does Isaiah say ho? Actually, a theology of Santa Claus could help us here because Santa Claus says ho, ho, ho. In other words, get your attention. It's not dig your garden. A lot of passages, some passages explain themselves. Mark 4, it's a parable of the soils. We have the four different types of soils. And the disciples are confused and Jesus explains what they all mean. So tell them what Jesus did. But if the text doesn't explain itself, then you must. That's your job. Don't just say, the text keeps saying, fathers, don't exasperate your children. Fathers, don't exasperate your children. Fathers, don't exasperate your children. Tell what exasperate means, you know? Explain what that means. Explain what children's means. Explain what fathers means, etc., you know? Now, if the text doesn't explain itself, you must, because perhaps the author assumed that people would understand. John 3:5, Jesus says to Nicodemus, you must be born of water and born of the Spirit. Now, if Jesus said that to you, what would you say? What in the world? Jesus, excuse me. What is born of water? That's what you'd say, right? What does Nicodemus say? How can a man go back in his mother's womb? Nicodemus didn't say, Jesus, excuse me, you're using this born of water thing. I don't understand what you mean. Nicodemus assumed he understood. And Jesus didn't say, by the way, born of water means this is... In other words, it's assumed in the text what that means. But it's not assumed for you and me. So if you're preaching on something that you don't think people are going to understand today, you better actually explain it. If your audience needs explanation, explain it. Don't go through your whole sermon with people not understanding what you're saying. If you have inductive introductions that give questions, in other words, you start your sermon with a question, well, you're assuming that the passage is going to give the answer there. So make sure if you raise a question at the beginning of your sermon that your sermon actually does answer it. Otherwise, you're not delivering the goods. You're promising delivery, and then you don't actually deliver it. So that's explain it. So I say it's going to be 30 degrees Fahrenheit. Now, do you believe that? You really don't, right? I mean, you walked to class, and it wasn't freezing when you walked to class today. The only one that has a jacket's Natalie, and it's because the air conditioner is too...
Oh, I'm comfortable.
You're comfortable, yeah. So you actually have to prove it. I have to prove to you if I say it's going to be freezing today. So I'm actually trying to answer the question, do my listeners believe this? If I try to tell my class that it's going to be freezing today, I don't think they're going to believe it. So I better prove it. BBC said it. It's about Siberia. They said in Siberia it's going to be freezing today. And I can tell you, it's freezing in Mongolia. I talked to one of my students in Mongolia yesterday. And he told me it was -24 degrees. So I can prove it to you, you know. He picked up the Skype and he showed me outside his window. I said, what was that? Looks like a little white powder out there. And he goes, that's called snow, Dr. Ray. Yeah. So if your audience needs you to prove it because you're making a statement, then prove it. Don't prove what your audience already accepts. You're wasting your time in your sermon. If I preach a sermon to you to try to prove that Jesus is God, I think I would be wasting my time, because you all already believe that. Unless I'm trying to give you some extra, this is how I want you to prove this to other people, you know. Prove it, even if the biblical and the modern audiences need it. Prove it if the biblical and the modern audiences need it. That's the idea there. Did I say that right? If the author is proving or defending something which your modern audience doesn't already exist, then prove it. Yeah, that's the idea there. For example, the resurrection of Christ. The first century audience accepted it, but maybe we don't accept it. So I would want to prove that to my audience if they didn't believe in the resurrection of Christ. Right? Prove it, even if the biblical audience didn't need it, but the modern audience does need proof. That's more along C. A third option is the biblical author may not be proving it, but the modern audience needs some defense or explanation. Jonah getting swallowed by a great fish, living there 3 days. The book of Jonah doesn't try to prove it to you. This is how it happened. This is how he breathed. This is how, you know, he doesn't go into all those details. He assumed that people believed it. When proof is needed, one of three problems exists. The audience, the listener, doesn't see the connection as one of those. You know? If I say, be nice to grandpa. Be nice to your grandfather because it'll help you have babies. Now, you understand the first sentence, right? Be nice to your grandpa. You basically understand what that means. It will have you, help you have babies. You understand that, right? But your mind is striving for the connection between the two. Can you help me with this? How will you connect those two? All right. Perhaps you're talking about Ephesians 6:3. if you honor your father and mother, and then it would be honor your grandfather as well, God will bless your life. And babies, let me tell you, a baby is the most amazing blessing you'll ever have in your life. You know, along with marriage. I mean, these are just some of the most wonderful blessings of God. How about, well, your grandpa actually is a gynecologist. He's a specialist in infertility. And no, if you're nice to him, maybe he'll give you a free treatment and you and your spouse can, you know, anyway. How about Colossians 1? Colossians 1, knowing God's will. I want you, Paul says, praise to the church. I want you to know God's will that will enable you to be patient with one another. We understand being patient with one another, but knowing God's will, how does that connect? See, it's your job as a speaker to make that connection. The audience might not make the connection, but you need to make the connection. So that's if there's not, if the audience, the listener doesn't see a connection. He also may not believe in the connection. Maybe he sees it. How about this one? Long life. You have a long life from honoring your parents. Do you believe that? You ever hear about the 7-year-old boy that got leukemia and died and loved his parents and honored his parents? You know stories about that. You're going to go, that doesn't seem, he didn't live very long. So I'm not so sure I believe this connection. If you really honor your parents, you're going to live long. There's lots of little boys and girls that die before their time. You catch the idea there? So you need to kind of handle that in some way. How about divorced Christians should remain unmarried for reconciliation? 1 Corinthians 7:10 says these two Christians are married and they're not getting along. They're separated. They should remain unmarried. If one of them divorces the other, the other should remain unmarried. Why? God wants them to reconcile. We go, I don't know if I believe that connection. You better prove it to your audience if that's you think the text is saying. On other times when proof is needed, something else is more important to him. For example, the person says, the guy says to his girlfriend, if you don't go to bed with me, you're not loving me. You say you love me, but you're not going to go to bed with me. There's a problem here, right? Because from the girl's perspective, boy, I have to make a decision here. Do I want acceptance from this guy, or do I want purity before God? Why would she go for the guy? Why would she go for the acceptance? Because it's more important to her, right? So your job as a speaker is to say, that may be more important, but purity should be more important. Keeping my job better than honesty. Hello? Yeah, this is Mr. Wong. I'm just calling about to see when you guys are going to pay the $10,000 you owe us. You know? Your boss says, is that Mr. Wong? Yeah, he's calling about the $10,000 we owe him. Well, tell him I'm not here. Is Mr. Wong there? I'm sorry, he told me to tell you that he's not here. No, that's how to get fired, right? you have to make a point. You have to just make a split-second decision. Am I going to keep my job? If I say what I just said, I'm losing my job. So a lot of people are willing to compromise their honesty to keep their job. So what you need to do is you need to paint these scenarios for people if you're speaking about honesty. You need to help them realize honesty is more important than keeping your job. My daughter-in-law just lost her job. You know, great job. She was fired. Why was she fired? The client asked specifically, does your company do this? She was honest. She said, we do. Probably shouldn't be doing this with you, but we do. And the client said, forget it. Forget the contract, you know. So they fired her, and then her boss fired her. Got fired from both, you know. She's a consultant, you know. Why? Because honesty is more important to her than keeping her job. And, you know, I commend her for that. She will accept it, but a lot of people won't accept it. So this is the idea. Explain it. What do I need to explain? Prove it. If my listeners don't believe it, they don't really buy it. But once they do, then you need to apply it. It's going to be freezing today. So how are you going to apply that? Yeah, we're still talking about Siberia. This is the so what. Where does it show up in real life? Here's my application for you. If you're going to Siberia in the next day or two, bring a heavy coat. Good application, right? Don't go there dressed like you are right now. You're just going to be freezing. Biblical author may be applying his statement. But even if he doesn't, you need to do so, because our preaching goal is not knowledge, but it's actually behavior. 1 Corinthians 8 says, knowledge puffs up, but love edifies. So knowledge alone makes us proud, but knowledge plus love helps us all. So do your application in two parts. Understand what the valid principle is. This is review, I think, from what you've had in your hermeneutics course. And then go for a concrete application of that passage. So if you know the passage says that fathers don't provoke your kids to anger, there's your concrete application. You end your sermon, you say, fathers, have you been provoking your children? The way you talk, what you say, etc., you get specific with them. Give some examples. There's extended application too as well. Hey, you know, you mothers, I notice that you keep elbowing your husbands like this. You know, they got a little bruise in their side, you know. Maybe God has a word for you as well. Help your husbands not to provoke them to anger. And maybe you have a little problem with this too. I've asked my wife many, many times, would you help me not provoke our sons to anger? And she's been wonderful at it. So I have a great relationship with our adult sons now. And I've learned a lot about not provoking them to anger, because my wife has so much insight, and she's helped me to gain a lot of insight. So the idea is to go from the flesh and blood of the biblical situation with real life examples. You abstract it. We want to make sure that we are not provoking our kids to anger, but really training them, gently training them. And then it will show itself with our real life modern day. That's really the idea. The Old Testament, Leviticus says, don't cut the corners of your crops. Really? Should we do that today? What's the idea? The idea, I think, is give the poor jobs. Let them work for a living. Don't just go and earn all this money and just give it to the poor, but let them come on your property and work. So, pay the beggar. This is what I've done sometimes when somebody's come to my door and they want money. I say, well, you know, actually, I'm a Christian, and the Bible says people should work. Would you like to work for me for a little bit? I'll pay you well. And some go, what? No. And they walk away. But I've given them the opportunity for work. Others have said, sure. I had a 10-year-old boy come. He was trying to earn money for camp. Instead of him begging for me, I said, you know, that tree actually needs to be trimmed right there. Would you like to do that? So I gave, he said, okay. I said, I'll pay you well for it. So he took the shears. He just decimated my tree. You know, but I still paid him $20. I like paid him, that's like $20 an hour. That's pretty good for a 10-year-old boy, you know. And I want to, I mean, it's probably the first time he's ever cut a tree. Because maybe everybody's just giving them money. Anyway, I'm getting off on other stories like that. But anyway, so there's our developmental questions. Explain, prove, and apply. What does it mean? Do they think it's true? And then so what? We want to address their ignorance, so we explain it to give them understanding. We want to address their doubt. If they don't believe it's true, we want to show validity so they will actually believe that what the text is saying is true. And we want to be relevant. We show the implications and the applications of it so that their behavior would change by us applying it. Margaret? We're moving from the exegetical idea over to the purpose bridge. Yeah. And that'll be our next session.
I mean, it was a statement is going to be using today, but in this case...
The it is the passage. And my, actually, the it is the my interpretation of the passage. Yeah, that's a good clarification. Thanks. So I'm saying the passage is saying such and such. I need to prove to my audience that that is what it's actually saying. I need to explain it. And they need to be with me. They need to agree with me. And then I need to apply it. If I go through my whole sermon and they don't agree with me, they say, no, you haven't provided any evidence for this. A lot of good it is to apply it at the end, because they're not with me. I want my audience to believe this. Last Sunday I preached on don't divorce. You know, Malachi 2:16. I hate divorce. So I wanted my audience to say, if God hates divorce, I hate divorce too. I am going to do everything I can to keep my marriage together. That's what I wanted to prove to them. And at the end, I applied it. But if they didn't believe me, believe God, that God wants, really doesn't want them to divorce, then a lot of good that does to apply it. Because these actually do go in this order. Explain first, so they know what you're talking about. Prove it so they actually believe it themselves, and then apply it so they see where it shows up in life.